This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg, and with Professor Stanley Aronowitz. Stanley is the director of the Center for the Study of Culture, Technology, and Work at the CUNY Graduate Center, a distinguished professor of sociology and urban education, author of a mere 23 books, and ran for governor of New York in 2002. He is one of the great public intellectuals of our time. He's known around the world for writing classics like False Promises, The Shaping of American Working Class Consciousness, hey, that was just a mere 40 years ago, and The Crisis in Historical Materialism, 30 years ago. His more recent books, such as The Jobless Future, How Class Works, and Ken, what are some of his other publications?
The Politics of Identity, Class, Culture, and Social Movements, and upcoming The Death and Rebirth of American Labor. And by the way, The Jobless Future was co-written with Bill DeFazio from WBAI's City Watch. Taught a new labor movement defines the philosophic road to travel and offers a foundation for our thinking about the solution to our economic quagmire, our growing wealth inequality and deepening poverty.
Stanley, do you know who that gentleman is that we're talking about?
Which one is that, Bill DeFazio?
Well, not Bill de Blasio, maybe later.
No, Bill DeFazio.
He knew that. We're just being...
You mean this mayor, this guy who just got elected? I know him.
Well, good. We're being kind of cute. But since you started with Bill de Blasio, and a special shout-out to our good friend Bill DeFazio, well, Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York, who won a sweeping victory in November, promising to address the city's deep economic inequalities, used his first State of the City speech to propose measures that he said would protect the poor, encourage immigrants to participate in city life, and raise the minimum wage to help lift residents into the middle class. We're going to give you an opportunity, Stanley. Why don't you give us some analysis of the de Blasio methodology for presumably equalizing the wealth gap in the city?
He's got three programs that he has to deliver on, and the first one is stop and frisk, and I think he's going to do that, and I think it's already beginning to take hold. If he doesn't do that, I think he's going to disappoint an awful lot of people, but I think already the people of the city of New York, most of the people are tired of this, and I think he's going to deliver somewhat on that. The second, he has to do something serious about raising the minimum wage, and the minimum wage in New York City should be anything close to $15 an hour. The national proposal of Obama's $10.10, which is still leaving people in the poverty range, $15 an hour in New York City doesn't get him much further, but at least it starts the process, and we'll see how far he's willing to go. And the problem, obviously, is that he has issues at the third level, which is the problem of the state. The state of New York is going to have to address the issue of early childhood education, and I wonder whether or not he's going to be able to overcome Mario Cuomo, who is basically a follower, if not a supplicant of Wall Street, and refuses to raise taxes on the very rich to be able to fund that. But there's something beyond those three that he's indicated in his State of the Union message, and I think it's going to be interesting to see how far he can go on that, which is going to require money from both taxes and from the federal government and agreement by the state legislature and the state governor. And that is, we have a city in which large numbers of our citizens of this city of New York work here, must work here because this is where whatever jobs there are still here, but can't live here anymore. It's getting much more difficult to live in New York City and the immediate surrounding areas because rents are too high. People can't afford to buy anything, that is to say, to buy an apartment or to buy a house, to have a condo or a co-op. The rent stabilization program and the rent control program are under severe attack. Landlords, in many ways, under the Bloomberg administration, got whatever they wanted. And we do need something in the neighborhood of a quarter of a million new houses, new apartments. Maybe if we had 200,000 or 150,000 to begin with, it would make a big difference. Bloomberg, in many ways, promised something, and he did not deliver because mainly he was interested in supporting luxury housing and the rich. as well as the very upper middle class and the corporations that actually have bought up vast amounts of luxury housing. And so we're in a situation right now where if people who work here can't live here, we have the ultimate measure of what inequality really means. Is this going to become the playground for the rich and the well-born? Are we going to continue to reverse the history of New York as a city of immigrants, a city of the poor as well as the middle class? When people talk about the middle class, you know, what they mean by it is very indefinite. As far as I can tell, the middle class really is people who own their own businesses, and secondly, people who have professions like lawyers and like doctors and maybe even professors like me. But when you really talk about the middle class, you're not talking about people who make $40,000, $45,000 family income or $35,000 or less. We're talking about a very specific group in the population. The working people of New York City are at risk, and that's really what he has to address. And if I had to make my guess, I would think he has a very hard road ahead, because either he's going to talk openly, as the right does all the time, about class struggle, or he's not going to talk about anything.
Stanley, Mayor Bloomberg left us a legacy of unpaid union contracts for 300,000 city workers.
That's right.
What's your thought on that as one of those city workers?
Yeah, well, I'm a city worker. We haven't gotten a raise in 4 years. The inflation rate in New York City is well above 3%. If you count it all up, we're probably 14 to 15% behind. We have a backlog of raises that we need of about 14% minimum to be able to even stay even, and then we have the issue of what happens the next 3 years or 2 years. The average city contract is about 3 years. That's going to cost a lot of money. So when you talk about raises and you talk about taxes and you talk about progressive taxes, the money's got to come from somewhere, and there are two places where it could come from. Either they increase the debt, which would be, I think, one option, which is a rational option, which is what happens whenever the United States goes to war. We just increase the debt because we have to subordinate the Iraqis or the Afghanistanis or anybody else. Or we have to raise taxes under the guise of balancing the budget and not increasing the deficit. And he's going to have to do one or two of the others, because if he doesn't do that, he has no money to be able to increase wages, which are terribly, terribly behind. My guess would be that the teachers union, which is a very powerful union in this city, and finally, after not supporting him in the Democratic primary, did support him in the general election, has now made a demand for 4% over three, four years, which would be pretty close to what I've just said, 14, maybe to 16%. I would suspect that he's going to make a deal with the teachers union. And he's going to give them, if not what they exactly want, he's going to make a deal so that there's a substantial increase. The question, what happens to the members of DC 37, 100 and I don't know how many, 20,000 workers who are largely not professionals, not high paid, people who are clerical workers and blue collar workers, and some are professionals, but mostly clerical and blue collar workers? Are they going to get the 4% or the 3.5%, which would end up to be the 14% that I've talked about? And then there's the whole group of people who are in District Council 1707, which are daycare workers. And then there are the home health care workers. And there are thousands of people who are making basically nothing. Are they going to get the raise? So the issue is going to be, how far will de Blasio go? But not so much de Blasio. How far will the labor movement go in fighting for what amounts to a reasonable increase in the past 4 years, and then what happens in the next 3 years?
Well, you know, since you brought that up, though, I must just a little caveat from my own perspective in terms of Bratton, which is the most awful possible appointment that I could have perceived of. It's not just stop and frisk, which they are certainly not going to stop. It's Comstat, it's broken windows, it's operation searchlights, and all the other ways in which
sure.
our youth in the African American and Latino communities will continue to be victimized and shuttled into the prison pipeline. Notwithstanding that, since you mentioned it, you know, there's a program coming up. Was organized labor once a poor people's movement, and can it be again? Now, certainly we saw during the last March on Washington organized labor out in full regalia, so to speak, talking about jobs and freedom as they had in the original March on Washington. So let's philosophically go there with organized labor. Can they indeed be the kind of pinnacle, the leadership of a real poor person's movement? And what would something like that really look like?
Well, there's two issues here. One of them is whether the unions can actually do it from the top, and whether the leadership of these unions, often representing workers who are making $20, $25, $35, $40,000 a year, which in New York City is really still a poverty wage, whether they're willing to exert that kind of leadership to become a new social movement for jobs and freedom. That's the first issue. And the second issue really is there enough rank-and-file protest and discontent, a membership who says, we've had enough, we've listened to you, we've listened to the leadership who says, this is not the time, this is not the time, and who basically subordinated themselves to the Bloomberg administration. Are we now going to take the opportunity during the de Blasio administration to make our demands felt? As far as the first is concerned, I believe, and this is maybe a little pessimistic, but I don't think it's unrealistic, unless the rank and file, unless the membership takes some initiative, I'm not saying all of the initiative, but at least some of the initiative, the leadership is still going to go along and take what they can get and then claim some kind of a victory, even if they don't get what they need. But it goes beyond wages. It's really about housing. It's not just about housing. And housing is terribly important. And we need new rental, affordable apartments, which doesn't mean affordable by the standards of the rich, but affordable on the standards of working people. Thirdly, we need the unions and the membership of the unions to be concerned about the education system. I mean, their kids go to school in which so much doesn't happen that it's amazing that people fret and their kids don't make it, and they end up graduating from high school. Often some of them don't, but when they graduate from high school, they end up in college, and then when they go to college, they don't graduate from college. They don't graduate from community college. They don't graduate from the four-year colleges, and now even the problem is that when you finish four-year college, you can't get a job in New York City. There's really deep, deep issues, and I think unless there's a public conversation as well as a conversation in the unions about what their responsibility is, are they going to become yet another time a social movement as they were in the early 30s and at the turn of the 20th century, or are they going to continue to be contented or basically not activist kinds of institutions that are simply going to collect dues and not do very much in relationship to their members' needs? And that's really the issue. The difficulty is that unless they do something, the working people of New York City are going to be crushed, even under a relatively rhetorically progressive administration of Bill de Blasio.
You had made a speech a couple of weeks ago at the Murphy Center in terms of employment and unemployment in the future, and added to the unknowable future, we have an unemployment problem. And you were talking about jobs and the lack of jobs. And two of the things that you mentioned, one of them actually I want to talk about right now, is a national guaranteed income, which is something that actually that Dr. King talked about in the last couple of years of his life. So that's beginning to percolate a little bit. I've seen some other articles about it. So why don't you talk a little bit about what that is?
In the early 1970s, no less a figure than Richard Nixon and his domestic policy advisor, who was Daniel Patrick Moynihan, proposed a basic income guarantee of $1,600 per capita per person. There was at that time a very strong welfare rights movement, largely of black women, who were protesting and raising a lot of hell in New York City as well as in other cities around the country. And the Nixon administration, to try to quell the discontent, made a proposal. And the proposal was turned down by the welfare rights movement and by a lot of liberals and progressives, for good reason, at least at one level, that is to say, it wasn't enough. But on the other hand, we didn't get our foot in the door. Now, since 1971, that's more than 40 years ago, since 1971, this issue has not been put on the table. There are two issues on the table related to that. One is the guaranteed income issue, and that's now beginning to percolate upward because what we've now realized, Ken, the jobs are not coming back. For a lot of people, they're not coming back. The idea that we have a cyclical economic situation in which eventually the recession is followed by prosperity, that's an old story. That's a story only that took place after the Second World War until about 1973. The jobs are not coming back. And if they're not coming back, how will people live? You know, they just cut $8 billion out of the food stamp program. You know, people are going to be hungry. And people are going to be unemployed. And so we do need a basic income program. The second thing is that if we're going to create jobs, it's not about infrastructure, as Obama says. If we're going to create jobs, we have to cut working hours. We can't have people working three jobs and, you know, 16 hours a day and in the same job 10 hours, 12 hours a day. We have to cut the working hours to 6 hours. And basically, we have to begin to speak seriously about a 30-hour week and spreading the work if we're going to create some jobs. We're not going to solve the problem of full employment, but if we had a guaranteed income program on one hand and a jobs program on the other hand based on cutting hours, then we might have the beginning of a solution. That question of cutting hours and basic income guarantee has not yet penetrated either the labor movement or the progressive left community, and I think that's a serious challenge to them to get away from the idea of full employment and begin to talk seriously about hours, to talk about basic income guarantee.
What exactly does that mean, though, basic income guarantee? Is that tied to a job?
No. Basic income guarantee has a number of different elements. The first one is that everybody who is of working age is entitled by right to a basic income guarantee, which would be something close to the minimum wage, that would then raise the wages of those people who are working. It would also mean that people who were working would have an incentive beyond the minimum wage to work at higher wages, and the pressure would be on those who are making $7.25 or whatever the minimum wage ends up being, employers to pay higher wages to get people to work. It would be, therefore, transferred from now being a buyer's market to becoming a seller's market. That is to say, those who have the skills and the willingness to work would say, if you want me to work, you have to pay me more. So you'd have this kind of pressure from below to raise living standards, and that would make a very big difference. Now, the problem is that we have a real unemployment rate, not of 6.7%, and even if we, you know, increase, we have people who have retired from the labor force, they withdrawn from the labor force because they don't find jobs. We have people who are working part-time, temporary, and precarious jobs that really, they begin today and end tomorrow or a week, 2 weeks, especially in the retail food industry, the people who do it, the servers in restaurants and so on. We have people who are contract laborers who work on this job and that job, and they don't have any real security. I have a son-in-law who actually works 2 days a week as in the film industry, and I have a student who's working 15 hours a day in the restaurant industry, you know, not all day, but all week, but he works 3 days a week in the restaurant industry. We have to start to say, look, a lot of the jobs, the so-called jobs that are counted by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, are not real jobs. They just work. And with the guaranteed income, what you begin to do is to see the incentive to the employer to hire people full-time. That is to say, and the incentive to the workers to actually organize for higher wages.
I've mentioned the issue of a left turn, that we need to unify and solidify the very disjointed and fragmented political movements. They're out there, but they are separate and very often somewhat disparate, although we had a hint of what it might mean to come together when we saw that glorious last march on Washington for jobs and freedom, and during the Occupy process when 35,000 people of different stripes marched over the Brooklyn Bridge. So Stanley, take it from there. Where do we go? How do we, creates a prairie fire?
I think we are at a moment when we have to begin to recognize, and I think we've already begun, that this system is not working, that the capitalist system is not working. But in order to be able to effectively fight that, we are now in a period when also there's 100 different organizations, and they're mostly single issue. We need to broaden to a political formation. Now, some people call it a party. We can call it whatever we want, an association, but we need a political formation that would be national as well as local, that would not have ideological means test in order to join it, that is, except that you really are for social change and for fundamental human dignity, that would be able to coordinate and to be able to coordinate especially the fight that needs to take place to take on the large corporations and their political toadies, and with local chapters, with local issues, as well as state and national issues that we can begin to fight on together. Now, if we don't have that, what we have is a fragmentation of 100,000, maybe 2,000, 5,000 different specific groups that are competing with each other because there's no way of them connecting to one another, and they seem to be, in many ways, they become ineffective because of that. But if we had a political formation that could allow for local organization, but also take on the international questions, I mean, look at the Iraq war and the Afghan war and what happened in Somalia and what happened in Rwanda, and what's going to continue to happen as long as American imperialism still runs the Washington situation. Unless we have an international and a national as well as local coordination, we're going to really, in many ways, expend our energy in a futile way. So I think we need a left turn all on the left as well as a left turn in the country that will say, look, the Democrats and the Republicans are not just are not the only options that you have. What we need is something else, and that something else is not necessarily always electoral. It's not electing this or that congressperson or senator, although that's not a bad idea, or local councillor or even a mayor. But it's really about coordinating our efforts to fight the fight that needs to take place and to create the alternatives, to advertise and to discuss the alternatives that people need to hear, because protest and resistance, while necessary, and Occupy did that beautifully, is not enough. We need to actually think about what would the good life be? What would the society that we want to live in be like? And we have to create the conversation, at least, that will begin to answer that question.
Well, in the interim, though, I mean, the fact is that one union has a protest, and they're at it alone, and maybe it's another union will send in a few staffers to stand on the picket line with a few flags or a few picket signs, and another union will be out there the next day with another, and nobody joins together. And, yeah, we need another organization. We need a new political party. We need new political formations. But there's no solidarity even in terms of straight trade union issues.
Well, we have a Central Labor Council, and I'm hopeful. I'm not saying it's guaranteed that this time around, with a new leadership in the Central Labor Council, that they may get around to beginning to address the issues, the trade union issues, in a unified way. I mean, it's not, yes, but, you know, in Europe and Latin America, in many parts of Latin America anyway, the labor movement is connected to political formation. The labor movement in the United States is connected to only one political formation, and that happens to be the Democratic Party. And whatever the Democratic Party's liberal wing is about, it's never good enough, because ultimately most of that liberal wing compromises, and in many cases compromises the union, the labor movement's demands away. For example, we know that $15 an hour is a bare minimum wage. But the trouble is, at this point, that the Democratic Party is nationally is committed to $10.10. And only in a very few places, namely in the West Coast, state of Washington, it has the $15 an hour minimum wage caught hold. Well, the unions should work together to fight in New York City, as well as in the East Coast generally, for a $15 an hour minimum wage. We ought to be fighting for the housing program that we need. And you know, when we talked about housing, my mother died in 2010. She died living in Penn South, which was a union-sponsored affordable co-op. She died with a one-and-a-half-bedroom apartment. My father died in 1967. They lived in the Northwest Bronx, the Amalgamated Project. This was an ILG project at 23rd Street. And paid $500 a month for a one-and-a-half-bedroom apartment, which today in that area would be $4,000. Why can't the unions take their pension funds? Why can't the unions take federal and state money and begin to build new housing with the support of a de Blasio administration or a federal housing program that would give their members who make $35,000 and $40,000 a year or less sometimes and even $50,000 or $60,000 decent housing that is now not being supplied by the private sector? Why aren't they fighting for that? Well, the clothing workers and the garment workers and the electrical workers and 1199 briefly in East Harlem fought for that kind of housing because they recognized, and they were never separate from federal and local support. They sponsored the housing. They said, our members need housing, and we're going to provide it through the union rather than wait for the private sector to come down, and never will come down in prices. We need that now. And a central labor council could coordinate that kind of fight. But I would suspect that it's going to only happen when the militants, the activists, the people who care about real social change and real social justice begin to unite themselves across the locals and the international unions that dominate the labor movement today.
One of the things that I saw you had written not that long ago was liberals are more afraid of mobilizing their own base than they are of the right. I want you to just speak to that a bit as well.
The liberals are afraid to mobilize their own base because their own base would thwart the liberals' ability, especially at the level of legislation, at the level of bureaucracy, of making the compromises that they feel they have to make, because the base is always more militant than the leadership. The base often makes demands that the liberals are not prepared to support, the liberal leadership anyway.
But I just want to say a true friend of the working class movement, Stanley Aronowitz, professor at the CUNY Graduate Center. Thank you for joining us. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.